It is amazing to think about and to consider everything that God sees. My sight is very limited. When you consider how much there is in this world and in this universe, my sight is very, very limited. I can see like the stuff in front of me in this room, and even that I'm not great at. My wife can, you know, tell me that the tape is in the drawer, and I open up the drawer and I look in the drawer and I don't see the tape in the drawer, and I tell my wife the tape's not in the drawer. And guess what? Just about every single time, the tape's in the drawer. I'm looking at the tape and I can't see the tape. Like, something can be 4 inches in front of my face and I won't see it because it's not the exact right color that I'm looking for or something. Like, sight is interesting. Some people have better sight than others. But when you think about the grand scope of what God sees, God right now sees every single square inch of the entire universe. That's just amazing to think about, that God can see all that there is at all times. God could see exactly what's taking place on the most distant star that there is. The physical universe, there's nothing going on in the shadows that God's unaware of. Whether you're deep in a cave, God knows exactly what's going on there. No matter where you find yourself, God can see it. In Psalm 136, David writes about this. He talks about whether I make my bed in Sheol or I go to the highest mountain, like, God is everywhere. God sees everything. But not only does God see all of the physical stuff out there, God sees all the spiritual stuff that's invisible to us. Like, he sees the demonic forces and the powers and the principalities. He sees angels. He sees every spiritual reality that there is, which I'm convinced may be just as magnificent, if not more so, than the physical world around us. I mean, there are intense spiritual beings and spiritual truths that God can see everywhere. And it's amazing to think about. But then not only that, God can see everything physical. He can see everything spiritual. When he looks at a person, he sees so much more in each person than we can see. You can look at a person and you may be able to kind of guess their age. You might be able to guess a couple things about them. You can notice some of their physical features and all that. But there is so much behind every single one of us that we're blind to. Every person you see on the street, every time you're driving and you pull up to someone at a stoplight and you have that brief moment where you make contact with someone else, that person has an entire life. They have an entire story. They have experiences. They have a reality that is completely different from your own. And you don't get to glimpse that. When you see someone who's angry and they shout in public and you think, man, what's that person's problem? You're seeing a brief moment of what is otherwise a very long story. And you don't know where they are on that story. It's one of the reasons we should be careful about drawing conclusions about people quickly, because we have a tendency to see a very little bit and to see for a very brief period of time. And if that's all you ever see of that person, you then think, well, that's an angry person. And you can like judge and define someone by their worst moment in that brief experience. When wouldn't that be terrible if your worst moment and the briefest of experiences became the way that people defined you from that point forward? There's so much that we can't see. It's hard not to do that, though, because we make judgments. We kind of have to an extent to survive, and we'll talk about that here in a second. But God can see everything. He sees every thought and intention of your heart. He sees your entire story. He sees your motivations. He knows your successes. He's aware of your failures. He knows how all of that combines in unique ways to make you, you. It's amazing to consider what God sees. All of that, all at once, all the time. Omniscience is an amazing concept. In 1 Samuel chapter 16, Samuel has been commissioned to go to Bethlehem and to anoint a new king. Saul has been chosen as the first king. He's from the tribe of Benjamin. And it seemed like things were going to go well with Saul. I mean, he looked like a perfect king. And even at the beginning, he had some features of a king, some personality traits that you might think could make for a really good king. In fact, he did some good things as a king. But slowly over time, he became the king you wouldn't want to have. He started messing some things up. He started choosing his own way rather than God's way. And you can read story after story, Saul ends up in many ways acting as unkingly as you can. And so because of that, Saul is going to be replaced as king. And that's what... Sorry. I thought something was coming through the microphone. Anyway, ignore that. So Samuel is sent to Bethlehem, and he is sent to go choose a new king. And so as he's going to select this new king, it's kind of a dangerous job. If you could imagine, you have a king, and you are sent on a covert mission to go and anoint someone else's king. That's an act of treason. And that's the call that Samuel has been given. And so he has to do this. God even gives him a story, basically, to go and offer sacrifice and to meet with Jesse while he's there. And one of the sons of Jesse is going to be the one who's going to become king. And so he goes there and he starts seeing some of the sons of Jesse. He sees one of them, the firstborn, Eliab, kind of like Saul. The man looks like a king. He's tall, he's powerful, he has everything you would expect a king to have. And Samuel's told not to choose him. As a matter of fact, he's given a very important description of his task. And it deals with that fundamental difference between the way we see and the way God sees. He's told, "Do not look at his appearance or at the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For God sees not as man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart." That's a fundamental difference between the way God sees and the way we see. That's something that we don't really have access to. You can meet someone and you can learn about them. You can have some experiences with them, but you'll never be able to see the depth and the reality of the innermost parts of that person the way God does. God sees the heart. And so the temptation with choosing a king is to choose someone who looks like a king. But God is saying, that's not the route that I want you to go. I want you to go a completely different route. I want you to choose someone who you would never otherwise choose. And then he ends up, as the story goes, choosing David. And we'll talk about that here in a little bit, but I want you to think about that concept for just a little bit. How many problems in this world are caused because of man's eyes? Because of the way we see things. We see human beings, and sometimes if they look good to us, they are nothing more than an object to us. And we can look at someone and we can devalue them. We can see them as nothing other than an end to satisfy the means of my lust. And you can take entire people and you can basically boil them down to an object that satisfies whatever I'm craving. Or you can look at someone and you can make grand opinions about them based on your opinions about their race or about where they've come from or about their nationality or things like that. And you can take someone you've never known before and almost immediately upon meeting a new person, you can define them in ways that are often unflattering. Prejudice, unjust leaders, people who might look the part, but then when they get in office, you find out they're not really what they thought, what they looked like they should be. So often poverty, so often what we think would make a great family here at church. We can look and we can make snap judgments about people. As soon as they walk in the door, as soon as you go to a restaurant and you see someone, as soon as you see your waiter, you start thinking, oh, this is going to be a good or a bad time. And all of a sudden, we start making judgments about people. And a lot of times, we act on those judgments. A lot of times, we treat those people differently because of those types of judgments. The way we see, humans, and I mean this, we're excellent at stereotyping. In fact, we are phenomenally good at that. And I don't necessarily even mean that in a bad way. So there are bad stereotypes. But the idea of looking at something and making judgments on it based on your past experiences with that type of thing is a really important skill to have. So if you see a strawberry and you think, I can eat that strawberry will taste good. You kind of know what it's going to taste like. You kind of know what it's going to feel like. Why? Have you ever eaten that strawberry before? No. But you've eaten other strawberries, you know, if you've eaten strawberries. But you've eaten other strawberries, and so you can make judgments about the next strawberry that you see. Or a chair. There are chairs. I go to a restaurant. I see them by a table. So they're in the location that they should be. They have four legs, and they look like they should look. I may have never sat on that chair before, but I know exactly what it is. I know exactly what to do with it, and I trust that it's going to hold me up. Why? Because I've seen chairs before, and so I can judge this chair based on all the other chairs. That's a skill that we have. And we do it immediately. We do it all the time with all kinds of things. Like, the only way you can identify a new thing is by stereotyping it, putting it into some category based on other things that you've seen. It's necessary. You have to do this. But are there problems that can emerge from this really fine-tuned skill that we have? There certainly are. This skill can save your life. If you see, you know, something that has a poison notification on it and you say, okay, based on other things with poison notifications, I should probably stay away from it. Don't put it in my food or something. Like, you need to be able to do this in order to survive. But then you can also do this and you can start making judgments about things that perhaps we ought not be making judgments about. There is something called the Warren Harding error. Basically, it comes, I read about it first, I think it was in Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink. There's a really good section on it, but you can look it up. There's a lot written about this. Warren Harding is considered by many to be one of the worst presidents in American history. But the reason they say he was chosen to be president, and why a lot of people thought he would be a good president, is because he looked very, very presidential. Like, he just looked like a president. He had the face of a president. He had the build of a president. He looked like a president, and so people thought he'd be a great president. Now, honestly, this is before my time, and I'm not a huge history buff on the presidency of Warren Harding, so if you like him, I'm sorry. But that's what they call the error, because a lot of people think that way. But here are some examples of the Warren Harding error. CEOs in this country. If you look at CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, and you compare their height to the height of an average man across the country, what you'll notice is that they are significantly taller. 30% of CEOs of Fortune 500 companies are over 6'2". That is in comparison to 3.9% of the rest of the country. If you look at CEOs, over 58% are 6 foot tall or above, as compared to just 14.5% of the rest of the population. There are studies that show people who have similar jobs and similar responsibilities, their height difference makes about like $700-something dollars a year per inch of height that you can factor out. It's kind of interesting. So for tall people, that works out really well. But it's something that, you know, might not work out if you're not so tall. Basically, there are things like this that pop up that there's nothing intrinsically about height that would make you a good leader. But there are people who you're more willing to listen to someone if they look a certain way. Here's another one, a sad one. Bald presidents. Since the household television became common, there have been no bald presidents since Eisenhower. And even then, it wasn't too common. But presidents, I mean, look at them. They generally have pretty good hair, or they do things to make sure that they have good hair, or they dye their hair, or they get a hair transplant. But one of the things that is important is looking. If you want to look presidential, you have to have hair. And you can see that, and I guess what, you have to be 35 to become president, so in a couple of years, I need a hair transplant if I ever have political aspirations. But anyway, the point that I'm making is there are correlations that you can find between certain ways people look and certain things about them. There's articles written about whitening resumes. This one's kind of sad, but basically, Asians and Africans, if you put on a resume and you send out like thousands of resumes, you make up resumes, send them out. They've done studies where they've done this. And they put very Asian names and very black sounding names on those resumes. You get significantly fewer calls back for interview than if you put white-sounding names. So they would take the same resume and they would change it from an Asian name to a white name, and then they would send the resume out, and they would get significantly more calls back about setting up an interview. And so one of the things that some minority groups do is they try to whiten their resume. They try to make it seem like they are more white, or they will. They'll put a nickname rather than their actual name that sounds more white. And people do this because it might increase their odds of getting an interview or getting something set up. Why would that happen? Why would height matter? Why would hair matter? Why would race matter? Well, it matters because we stereotype. And it matters because we see differently than God sees. Sometimes I think even in churches, we can do this type of thing. We can see some people who walk in and you think, oh, great. You kind of smile at them. You don't want to be rude to them, but you're wondering, what do they want? Or you're wondering what issues are going to come because they have walked into this building. And you see another group come in, you think, oh, we need to meet them. We need to make sure that we get their contact information. We need to make sure there are people greeting them and visiting them. We need to make sure that they feel welcome and people are sitting next to them. Why? Well, because they're the right-looking type of family. As though the souls of some people are more valuable than the souls of others. I'll tell on myself. There was a time, and this was early on in my ministry, I was in Texas, and there was a man who came in, and he had come in a couple of times before, and you could tell, lived a rough life. You could tell that he didn't have a good situation at home. He didn't have running water at his house, and he was very large, and basically, I'll just say it bluntly, he was one of the worst smelling people that I've ever met. I was in my office, and I could smell him from the hallway, and it was tough. We had different Bible classes set up. There was the auditorium class, and then I was teaching a small group in a relatively small classroom with a couple of people around the table, and I remember him talking to one of our elders about what class he was going to go into, and they were mentioning the small group class, and they were mentioning the big auditorium class, and I was thinking, how in the world am I going to teach this class if he goes in there? And I was thinking, please choose the auditorium class. And it was about that moment that I recognized the trap that I was falling into. I was looking at a person who didn't have the same experience as I had. I was looking at a person who, he probably wasn't someone who had a lot of money to give to the church. I was looking at someone who wasn't pleasant to smell. I was looking at a person who, there were a bunch of things. And all of a sudden, I was hoping that someone else would teach him rather than me teach him. And I had to go teach here in just a minute, and I realized, man, what in the world am I doing? I think it's something that even if you have good intentions and you can fall into these types of traps if you're not careful. And you can say, well, I have a justified reason. But maybe you don't. Maybe we should overcome our reasons. Because people matter. Because God doesn't see the stench. God doesn't see the clothes. God doesn't see the height. God doesn't see the amount of hair on the head. God sees the heart. And when he tells Samuel to go choose a king, that's what he wants him to do. That's how he wants him to do it. He wants him to choose who God chooses. And notice it'll be quite different than who Samuel chooses. So that's something that happens quite a bit. David was chosen. He was the youngest son. You could look at 1 Samuel 16 and verse 11. After seeing all the other sons, Samuel says, they were all told no. So he says, do you have any other ones? He says, well, I have one. He's the youngest, but he's out in the field. He says, well, bring him in. And so the youngest boy, the smallest one, is the one who is chosen to be the king. And that idea of the surprise choice is a very common idea in the Bible, especially when it comes to age. So if you were to read Deuteronomy 21:17, it says this, he shall acknowledge the firstborn. This is talking about fathers and who they give their inheritance to. He shall acknowledge the firstborn by giving him a double portion of all that he has, for he is the beginning of his strength. To him belongs the right of the firstborn. The idea there is the firstborn son gets the preeminent blessing. He gets the double portion because he's the first one that the father was able to continue on his lineage through. And so he should get some sort of privilege for that. If you were to read this passage, you would think, okay, so God prefers firstborns, right? That's what the law is. But there's two things about this passage that are really interesting. The first is this is actually written about a unique situation where, say, a husband has two wives, which is not a good situation, and He doesn't love one, and he does love the other one. And the one he does not love gives him the firstborn. He might be tempted to give the double portion to the son of the woman he loves. And this passage is saying, don't do that. That would be despicable. You treat the firstborn the way the firstborn should be treated. But secondly, which is a call to a higher level of righteousness that I think is important. Don't mistreat your children or break your standard based on the way you view the spouse and all that. But secondly, I think it's evidence of the fact that even as you read through the Old Testament, there are going to be things in there sometimes that maybe God puts in because of the hardness of men's hearts, but they're not always actually the divine will of God. Because one of the things that is really fascinating is God has this in the scripture. So that was practiced in Israel, where they would give the firstborn the double blessing. But if you go through the Bible and look at every time God specifically chooses someone, he subverts this idea. God, like, goes against it. You can go all the way back to the beginning, Cain and Abel. Whose blessing did he accept? The younger brother, Abel. Cain was the firstborn, but God seemed in some way to prefer the sacrifice and the blessing of Abel. And you might think, well, that was just because of the sacrifice. That was just a one-off thing. Look at every sibling pair in the book of Genesis, and you'll see the same thing continued. Ishmael and Isaac, which one was firstborn? Ishmael. Which one did God choose? Isaac. Jacob and Esau, who was firstborn? Esau. Who did God choose? Jacob. Joseph was the 11th out of 12, so not lastborn, not firstborn. But then he has two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. Manasseh is the firstborn, but Ephraim receives the blessing. As a matter of fact, when he sets them before Jacob, the father, to bless them, and he puts the one under the right hand would be the one who receives the double blessing, the firstborn, and the one under the left hand would get the lower portion, he switches his hands. Why? Because from the beginning of Genesis, all the way back with Cain and Abel, to the very last couple of sons in Genesis there in Genesis 49, what you have is this idea that God does the unexpected. And some of our cultural norms and some of the things that we have structured society by, they're not the things that God is subject to. God doesn't have to follow the way that we want to do things. And these are examples. David's an example of that. Humans would have chosen Eliab, the firstborn. He was the best looking. He's the tallest. He's the oldest. He's the firstborn. Choose him. But instead, David gets chosen. Why? Because God doesn't see as man sees. You can continue this idea just by looking at Samuel. The book of 1 Samuel does this quite a bit, where if you find out that someone is tall and good looking and has hair, that person probably is going to be set up for some sort of fall. Hannah's prayer at the very beginning of the book kind of lays this out. Look at some of the things she says. She says, boast no more so very proudly, and do not let arrogance come out of your mouth. She says, the bows of the mighty are shattered, and the feeble gird on strength. So notice there, the mighty warrior, his bow hits the target and just shatters. You know, his bow breaks in his hand. He's unable to succeed. But the weak one, they put on strength. Those who were full hire themselves out for bread. So the people who are very full and have eaten a bunch, now they have to go hire themselves out just for bread. But those who were hungry cease to hunger. All of these are ways that revert, like what you would expect and what you've seen is being reversed. Even the barren gives birth to seven, but she who has many children languishes. Now, this is Hannah, right? Hannah was barren. This is the beginning of the book. She can't have a child. And she's in that situation that we talked about earlier with Deuteronomy, where she has a husband with two wives. And one of them can have children, the other one cannot. And so she prays to God, and then she becomes pregnant. And this is her prayer about that. And she's talking about how God always unexpectedly reverses fortunes. She says, he raises up the poor from the dust, and he lifts the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with nobles. If you were to look at a group of people, and you were to choose who here is going to sit with the nobles, he's saying God chooses those who are poor and those who are in the ash heap. That's a surprise. That's not who we would choose. He says, for not by might shall man prevail. That's the way we tend to think about things. If you can pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, then you're the one who's going to be the most successful. You're the one who's going to prevail. But she's saying it often isn't by might that man prevails. If you were to look at the characters throughout the books of Samuel, you'll see that King Saul is introduced as looking like the perfect king. It says he stood head and shoulders above everyone else. You'll see Goliath looks like the perfect soldier. The guy is like a giant, and he can, I mean, his attire and his armor is so heavy, and he can destroy anyone. He's a military tested. You can look at Absalom, who's the son of David, the perfect prince. I mean, he weighs his hair every year after he gets it cut off because there's so much of it. Every time I mention hair, people smile and giggle, and I'm offended by it. But anyway, but he weighs his hair. It says he's the best-looking guy in all of the land. He's like the perfect-looking son, and you have the perfect-looking soldier, and you have the perfect-looking king. But what happens to all three of them? They all meet their end. God doesn't always see as man sees. God sometimes says the bow of the mighty will be shattered. And you see that with Goliath. You see the poor lifted up to sit with nobles. You see the youngest son who becomes the king. You can compare these great-looking people who you would expect victory from with Hannah, the barren woman who cries her eyes out at the temple, but then becomes a mother. Or Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth was the son of Jonathan, who's a really good friend of David. Mephibosheth was a crippled. He had become crippled as he was being carried during a battle. He was dropped as a young kid, and he couldn't walk anymore. And he, you would expect, may be one of the ones who was cast aside. Yet he's one of the only from the household of Saul who is able to live on in the palace of King David. He lived on in the palace. Then you have David himself. He's the youngest. He's the smallest. But then you do get this interesting note in 1 Samuel 16. It says he was ruddy with beautiful eyes and a handsome appearance. And you notice that David is handsome. So he's the youngest, but he's also really handsome. And when you look at his life, you can see some of that balance, some of the tension of you expect him to be the great king, and he seems like he's a great king, but he certainly has his faults. You would think, oh, he's the youngest son, he'll never be king, but he is good looking. And so you can kind of see how often the way Samuel is told, beauty, height, and those types of things, they play a role in the story of the characters. Well, I think this might go all the way back to Hannah's prayer at the beginning. The idea that God often acts in unexpected ways. You can see it throughout the Bible. You can see if God wants to start a nation, he does so with the elderly barren couple who have never been able to have kids before. When God wants to lead a revolt, he chooses the man who has been living as an exile because of murder, who was raised actually in prominence. So it's like he was raised by the Egyptians in royalty so the Israelites wouldn't trust him. But then he killed an Egyptian so the Egyptians won't trust him. And that's who God chooses to free his people. Israel itself. If you were to think, all right, who is God's chosen nation? You might, looking at the world back then, think Egypt. They're the most powerful. They have the most wealth. But here's the thing. Whoever's the most powerful and has the most wealth isn't always necessarily God's chosen people. Sometimes it's the least one you would expect. Israel, there was nothing significant about Israel. They were slaves in Egypt. And if you were to ask, what is God's favorite nation today? And you were to hear some country you've never even heard of before that's small and impoverished, you would think, really? But that's what it was like to say the Israel. And that's the way that God tends to work. God tends to do things in that unexpected way. King David was the youngest brother. Zerubbabel, his grandfather was a king rejected by God, and he was born in exile in Babylon. And yet he was chosen to rebuild the temple. The disciples, the people who were going to be the greatest teachers and bring this kingdom to the world, were people who were fishermen and uneducated. Or you had some that were like tax collectors, and you had some that were zealots, and you had some that were fishermen who otherwise would never, ever, ever, ever get along. And yet God chooses through Jesus this group of the most unlikely individuals to form a world-changing team. You can look at Saul, the one who persecuted Christians and hated the way of Christ. And God says, that's the one who I want to be my missionary to the world. You can look at Jesus himself, the crucified one, who is in fact the king of the world. God has a way of taking the thing you would never expect and making it the most beautiful reality that there is. So here is the challenge as we draw our lesson to a close. Let's work hard to be aware of our biases, fight against our prejudices. They're going to happen. You'll find yourself, you know, with prejudices. That happens sometimes. It might be different things, but try to be aware of what they are. If you find yourself preemptively judging another person, call yourself on it. Don't let yourself do it. Try to work in the opposite of that. We don't see as God sees. When someone comes into this building, James has to tell the church to work on this. He says, you know, don't greet the wealthy looking person and have them come sit on the good seat, and then the poor person, you say, you go sit on the floor over there. He says, God doesn't show that kind of partiality. We shouldn't either. No matter who it is, whether it's a neighbor, whether it's here at the church building, whether it's coworkers, try to treat people with the love and the respect that God does, as someone who was created in his likeness and in his image. And if there's anyone here who wants to become a Christian this morning, who wants to be a part of this family and this body here, we invite you to join us. If there's anyone here who has need of prayers, we pray that you would let us know. There's going to be some elders available in the library if you want to talk to them. If anyone wants to be baptized, come talk to us. We would love to help you in any way that we can. If you have a need, let it know. Be known while we stand and as we sing.